Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about the Tom Cruise science fiction epic Edge of Tomorrow, which was released in the summer of 2014. A little background about this film. This particular intellectual property was what the Japanese call a light novel. It was written by a guy named Hiroshi Sakurazaka. It was released in Japan in December of 2004. They call light novels novels that are between maybe 40 and 50,000 words long, which I think is a little bit more than we think of as a novella, and definitely a little bit less than, you know, your average novel these days, which tend to be longer than they used to be. From this novel, this light novel, I need to read like the Wikipedia. I'll paraphrase a little bit the Wikipedia entry, just to give you an example of how things get written in big Hollywood movies. And, you know, this is a Tom Cruise movie, so it's a big deal. So from the light novel, it was originally wrote on spec by a guy named Dante Harper. So basically on spec, meaning he wrote it for free in his spare time. It took about 8 months and wrote it. No one paid him for it. Spec, basically you write something on your own because you think it's going to be worth something, and then you try to sell it. If you're an established writer, you know, you're actually paid to write a script, and, you know, whether it's any good or not is doesn't matter. You still get your money. Then it was reworked by some guy named Joby Harold. From there, Roberto Orsi and I think it's Robert Kurtzman did a draft. These are the Transformers, Star Trek reboot guys. They're like, you know, the billion-dollar team. Then 6 months before filming started, Doug Liman, who's the director, and I'll get to more about his background, discarded two-thirds of the Dante Harper original script. These two guys, Jez Butterworth and John Henry Butterworth, I guess brothers, were hired to rewrite the script. Then screenwriter Simon Kinberg took over from them. And then 8 weeks before start of filming, Christopher McQuarrie took a crack at it. So McQuarrie came on board because he worked with Cruise in Jack Reacher, which came out a couple of years before. And supposedly McQuarrie kind of got it and, you know, put the final polish on it in terms of, you know, seeing what he thought Cruise wanted. Just the main principles: Tom Cruise, obviously. Emily Blunt is in this film. It was directed by Doug Liman, who directed the film Swingers way back in the day, and the first Bourne movie, The Bourne Identity, and also directed the Brad Pitt Angelina Jolie film, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So Liman had a pretty decent track record before this film. So let's get right to it. The film opens cross-cutting between the credits and what looks like kind of a documentary-style setup. And we're getting these newscasts, which show the arrival of the aliens, seemingly in a single large comet that crashes. And then through, you know, basically interviews and other footage, and we see some animatics. We see that they're slow spread throughout Europe. So Europe is basically being overrun by these aliens. And we hear a throwaway line in one of the newscasts saying, "They seem always to be able to anticipate our actions." And obviously that's going to play a big part in the plot. So there's a little bit of a teaser. It's a great opening because we don't see any aliens or any ships or anything. It's very realistic. And as I've said in previous podcasts, you know, when you ground your speculative or fantastic idea in something as, you know, gritty, as real as you can get it, you know, you're starting off with a really on a solid footing. It's very solid. I mean, this could be the opening film of simply a Tom Cruise thriller about terrorism. You know, it's that much. They show nothing. It doesn't play any of its cards when it's open. So it's a really solid opening. And part of this opening, we hear about this Battle of Verdun. And this is basically obviously harkening back to the famous Battle of Verdun in World War One, and that we hear that this is the first, you know, human victory over the aliens, who are called the Mimics. And there's this, the hero of that battle, it's called the Angel of Verdun, and we'll come to meet her in a little bit. And we see her plastered all over posters. And we're also introduced to the technology that was introduced into that Verdun battle called New Jacket technology. And basically, you know, for sci-fi fans, these are military exoskeletons. So where a soldier kind of gets in harness, sort of battle armor, and, you know, there are large weapons that are all moved by motors and, you know, making the soldier sort of like half robot, half soldier. And so we see that called New Jacket technology is kind of like a new thing. So throughout the introduction, we see Tom Cruise playing sort of a military PR guy, and he's in a lot of the interviews and a lot of the newscasts, you know, sort of selling the war, as it were. The movie opens proper where we see Cruise on a helicopter heading into London, and his character's name is Major William Cage. He goes to see this General Brigham, played by Brendan Gleeson. We get a sense from some exposition that Cage was in advertising back in the States, but since the war has changed the entire world and that his advertising firm tanked, and so he wound up going into the Army and became an Army PR guy. For whatever reason, General Brigham wants to use Cage to kind of sell this invasion. And basically, they're on the eve of some huge Normandy-like invasion, and it is going to be, you know, on the shores of France. A lot of similarities with World War II at this point. Basically, Brigham says, look, you know, you're going to be on that beach tomorrow with these soldiers and a camera crew. I want you on there. Cage is correctly just, you know, completely declines and says, look, I'm not a soldier. And he's completely saying, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And then Brigham, you know, pulls rank and he says, look, I spoke to your CO already. You've been drafted and you're going to be on that beach tomorrow with a camera. Cruise stands up and he tries to play a card and he tells Brigham that, look, it would be really bad if this offensive didn't go well and you were kind of blamed and the finger was put on you. And he basically tries to blackmail Brigham. And then he kind of gets desperate when Brigham doesn't budge and he's desperate to do anything to get out. And at some point, Brigham kind of, you think that Cruise has blackmailed him and he walks out of the office and he's arrested and tased and he goes down. I want to say a little something about Tom Cruise because I don't think he's the greatest actor ever lived, but when you watch a Tom Cruise movie, the guy, he's convicted, you know? He's like that rock singer, or like many rock singers who don't have natural gifts, but they throw their entire soul up into their voice, and it doesn't matter, you know? And I feel like that's Cruise a lot in films. I appreciate it because when I go to a Tom Cruise film, I rarely, if ever, feel like he's mailing it in. I feel like he cares about what's going on up there, and he's convicted in what he does. You know, he doesn't have the greatest range, but he does what he does best. He's a movie star, you know, and when he's on screen and he's doing what he does, he is always full of conviction. And I really appreciate that. So just wanted to, you know, give Tom a little shout out because, you know, he's not doing so well, so he could probably use my support. Now Cage wakes up at this base, this army base called Heathrow Base, and it's basically an ad hoc army base set up at Heathrow Airport. And he finds out that he's been busted down to recruit, stripped of his rank. He's given boots and by a master sergeant who comes up to him. And then his full-on master sergeant arrives, and it's Bill Paxton. Paxton plays Master Sergeant Farrell. And I have to say, I'm not a Bill Paxton fan. I think he's a really goofy, bizarre actor. I rarely liked him in anything. You know, I liked him inversely in Aliens, you know. We're screwed, man. Game over, dude. You know, this whole shtick. But I rarely like him in films. But he is perfectly cast in this as the, you know, sort of elder master sergeant. He's got this laconic little southern drawl. Nothing too showy, but just enough. You know, there's a brief conflict between the two of them where Cage is basically like, look at me. You know, I don't belong here. I just want to make a phone call. Please, you got to help me out. I got to call my CO. He pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket and basically says, you know, we got the word on you, buddy. You know, you're a deserter. So Brigham did him dirty. I mean, not only did he just bust him down a recruit, he kind of forged his papers in saying that Cage is a deserter. And he's not a straight-up deserter. It's kind of a complicated thing. He was kind of, you know, unfairly drafted in a weird way. So they march Cage off to his meet his platoon, and we get this first large-scale shot of the Heathrow base, and it's very cool. It's sort of these military, we see these military drop ships, which are kind of based off of the V-22 Osprey vehicle that I think the Marines have now, where it's a tilt rotors, sort of get it up in the air vertically and then and shift and it becomes an aircraft. Very nice shot, very cool, looks very realistic. And we see a lot of temporary army, you know, barracks erected in Heathrow Airport. He's brought into his squad, which is called J Squad. And he's in handcuffs at this point. Farrell basically tells J Squad that Cage is a deserter. And, you know, Farrell has all these great little, you know, he does the drill instructor thing pretty good. He's got all these little sayings like, you know, you will be born in the baptism of fire and courage is born on the battlefield and you will be born again and all this great stuff. And they're good lines, you know. And he's got this kind of quasi smirk on his face. But you get the sense that they're like, they're going to frag this guy, that being a deserter, that like they're setting him up to just basically get killed as soon as he hits the beach. You know, we're with Cage at this point. We're like, looks like he's going to buy it very quickly. So the next morning, they suit up for this huge offensive, and they put Cage in one of these New Jacket exoskeletons. They look good. I mean, they look very heavy and tough. They don't look like paper mache set pieces. They look like these are really metal pieces. And I think they were, from a little bit that I read about the film, I think that most of the cast wore like really heavy, they're very heavy armor. You know, we're definitely in Aliens, Cameron's Aliens territory here with the Marine grunts doing their shtick. One of the guys is naked under all of his armor and you see his butt, you know, he walks around and they're giving him shit about it. And it's good, you know. I mean, if this is the kind of stuff that Macquarie brought to the script, I mean, it's necessary because it strikes that rare action, serious slash comedy balance, you know, where you it's serious enough film that what's going to happen to Cage is going to be for the marbles, right? And you're going to have to put him through his paces so you as an audience member are fearful for his safety. And at the same time, you know, you get some good wisecracks because life is difficult and humor is necessary. I think it's impressive that they really, that balance is found here very quickly and it's maintained for most of the film, I would say. One little piece of information is that they won't tell Cage where the safety is on his armor. So at this point, you know, unless he figures it out, he's going to be dropped into the war zone with, you know, inoperable weapons. And you know, the rest of the J Squad don't give a shit. You know, being a deserter, they're happy to let him die. So then we get kind of a big scale shot of all of the, you know, the military personnel getting ready to for the invasion. It's a big shot, lots of men in armor, lots of dropships. Looks great. Lyman does a great job. Then we're inside the dropship, and you know, there's that sort of dropship scene, right, where they're all joking back and forth with each other, and there's this joke about look, there's you know, look what's inside that armor, or what, a dead man, you know, and basically they're all laughing, and Cage is just panicked because he's, you know, he's basically near death. So they prepare to drop, and before they can actually do it, the dropship is hit by enemy fire, and a big chunk of it gets ripped away. Pretty cool shot, too. Pretty good, very up-to-the-minute 2014 special effects, like very visceral, very right-in-your-face, surprising, you know, like a car accident, as it were. So finally, they'll wind up dropping, and there's a great shot as they're dropping, where they're dropping on these cables. The dropship is still in the air, but it's wildly off course and it's not being controlled, and so they're all spinning around on these cables, and you hear the sound of, like, you know, that cable sound when a cable is whacked by something. And it's really cool, good Foley work. Like it's a nice realistic scene. It takes a while for Cage to get to the beach, you know, and he finally does drop. So basically, Cage's battle here is fairly short. The combat looks really good, though. It does not look very CGI-ish. Lyman shoots it really well. It looks very realistic. All the things looks very substantial. The ships look substantial. All the men on the beach look substantial. Very, you know, kind of Saved Private Ryan for sure. And we finally see a mimic, and the mimics are these weird kind of like octopus-like creatures. They're like many tentacled, and they can burrow underground and come up from anywhere, and you know, they roll and scooch across the ground really fast. They kind of reminded me in a way of the squids of the Matrix trilogy. They're really cool. I mean, they definitely, you know, do a great job, and because, you know, designing aliens these days, who's any good at it? And when do we, you know, see aliens that are really interesting looking? And they're usually variations of bugs of some kind. So, you know, they're not the most interestingly designed aliens, but they're done well. You get it. You really feel that they are there and not that they're super CGI, which is surprising. Then we see the Angel of Verdun. The character's name is Rita Vertansky, played by Emily Blunt. Cage sees her fighting one of the mimics, and she's killed right in front of him. Which is, I think, a really nice anticlimax. Like, you know, as a movie viewer, like, oh, there's the co-star of the film. And in the film, she's this big, you know, great hero. You know, in the opening sequence of the main, you know, act one of the film, she's killed, you know, which I like it. It was a nice kind of turn. The humans are getting slaughtered out there. The mimics are just way too powerful and badass, frankly. So, you know, whoever's left in J-Squad, they regroup in a crater. They're about to advance out of the crater when a mimic pops up right in the midst of them and just starts killing them all. Things get really gritty here. There's lots of dirt flying around from the mimic, you know, tunneling upwards and going crazy. And it looks really cool. I mean, it's fast and it's cut, you know, in a modern, fast way, but it works for some weird reason. I wasn't thrown out, or I didn't feel like it was blizzard of cuts. Like something about it kind of works. During this sequence, Cage finally gets the safety off of his weapon and winds up killing the mimic, and he just starts laughing because the whole, you know, his whole short little life here is just so absurd, and he kind of gets it. Then we see another mimic. It's a different, it's kind of larger and blue. It's different from the other ones that we've seen. And it basically sees Cage, and he has seconds. And he grabs a claymore mine, which some early back in the at the base when they were suiting up with armor, some of the soldiers strapped these claymores to their chest. And if they were incapacitated on the beach, they would wait for a mimic to come up to them and then trigger the claymore, killing the mimic, of course, and themselves. So Cage remembers that. He grabs the claymore, holds it to his chest, and when this mimic comes at him, he detonates it, you know, blows the mimic away, which dies kind of right on top of him. But Cage is dead too, and we see his face is like all desiccated. And then the blood from this mimic kind of just flows into his face, and his eyes kind of go black. And then the film cuts. We're back to him waking up on Heathrow Base, which is where the scene starts, you know, after he gets sort of drafted. We're basically in the first replay, and he's living the scene that we've already seen, but with knowledge of the day that passed. So he's retained, you know, this knowledge. Basically, if you've seen the film Groundhog Day, the premise is very similar. So he's got this prior knowledge, and he's remembered a couple of things from the first time through, and when Master Sergeant Farrell's going into one of his sayings, Cage kind of mimics him, and Farrell looks at him, you know, strangely. He's again taken a J Squad. You know, what they do, which is what Groundhog Day does, is there are certain sort of touch points that are done as part of every day, like the one touch point of Farrell talking to him. There's a touch point of the poker game. There's a poker game that when he's first introduced to J Squad the first time, they're playing poker, and Farrell sees a card tucked in underneath a piece of the blanket. So he opens it up and he catches them and he makes them eat the card. So there's a bunch of things like this, which is good because it's really great for the viewer because it grounds you. You're like, oh yeah, that scene. Oh yeah, this little moment. And so you don't have a shapeless scene each time. There are these nicely crafted sort of what I call hard points that every time you see them, it's easy to remember what happened last time. So kudos to the writing up until now. It's because it's really fantastic, deceptively so, I should say. Goes through the whole day, and we cut much quicker, obviously, through that. We're back to the drop zone. We're back to the explosion in the drop vehicle. Back to him on the beach. The last touch point on the beach was the guy who's in the big, you know, the guy who's in the armor naked. When Cage hits the beach, he gets killed by an exploding dropship, just kind of stomps on him. And this time, Cage yells at him, tries to warn him, and he's not in time, and he gets killed. He fights through the same way, and then he saves Vertansky, who died the first time, actually saves her from getting killed, but he takes a fatal wound. And her response is by taking his extra battery, knowing that he's going to die. And again, it's a nice turn from what you would think you would expect of this, quote, hero. That she's just, you know, she's trying to stay alive like everybody else. So it's pretty good. He dies again and he wakes up again in the same place. This time he tries to explain to Farrell what's going on. He's like, look, you're not going to believe me, but, you know, I've lived this day twice before and so on and so forth. And he tries to impress him with all this knowledge that he has. When he gets the J Squad, he knows everyone's name and he knows what cards they've held in the card game. And he knows that one of the guys fights naked. And, you know, he has all this prior knowledge that there's no real way to explain except to go along with his explanation. But in another funny moment, right, and we cut to the dropship, and Cage has tape over his mouth. They duct taped his mouth so he would shut up. So he drops again, hits the beach again, and this time he actually saves the big guy from getting killed by the aircraft, but he's killed. And then we're back again to another day, and we see him back on the beach, and he saves the big guy and survives. And then he's heading towards Vertansky to save her. He's hit by a truck. Which is funny, you know. There's a nice balance here. It's struck between his incredible predicament and then this wild humor. You know that, you know, I laughed when he got hit by that truck because I know that when he wakes up the next day, he's going to know where the truck is and he's going to make it. The film picks up at this point. Like, what's great about the direction here, probably even more than the writing, is that once the film has shown you how this works, then they can kind of you know, how they do it is then, you know, when Cruise makes a mistake or when Cruise dies, they just pick it up when he makes his next attempt and succeeds where he dies the last time. So the film really moves fast. Like, it's very entertaining in that way. You pick right up where, you know, you were. And so you're seeing how he's learning his way onto this beach and into this battle. It's terrific. So this time he finds Vitansky and she's about to be killed, but he saves her. And he saves her by killing mimics in a way where, you know, he's done this before. So, you know, there may be even more times that we've seen that he's tried to save her. And he tells her that, you know, we're fucked. They know we're coming. I've lived this day before. And strangely enough, Vitansky says, you know, when you wake up, come find me. This is the first of sort of this new moment of like someone else knows what's going on with him. The next day, he resets. And this time, he runs to J-Squad. He hides the poker game before the sergeant gets there. And then we see a scene we hadn't seen previously, him running what they call PT, I guess physical training, on the base. And as he's running, there's some point where he is able to squirrel away from them by rolling into the path of an oncoming truck. And his, you know, goal is to roll through it and then kind of, you know, run next to it and escape. And the first time he tries it, he gets squashed and Farrell walks over. He's like, now, why in the hell did he try to do that? So it resets. Next time he gets through it. So he, you know, escapes for the moment from his squad and he goes to this area where, you know, it's like a firing range where they, where guys in new, you know, men and women in new jackets and practice killing sort of metal versions of mimics. You know, it's a way to kind of get acclimated to how to fight in these things. This is where we meet, you know, Emily Blunt for real, Sergeant Rita Vitansky, you know, and she's alone in the middle of the floor with her hand, you know, like doing this, this balancing motion on her hands. So he goes up to her and, you know, she's completely assholish to him and like, what do you want? What are you looking at, soldier? You know, that she's supposed to be really tough. He tells her about what just happened. And she basically, you know, gives him a little exposition, you know, don't tell a soul what's happened. They'll throw you in the loony bin, you know, and she's about to take him to see someone else who knows about what's going on. So I want to talk a little bit here, pause for a second, talk about Emily Blunt, talk about, you know, women in action movies. I don't really like Emily Blunt in this film. I don't know much about her. I mean, I looked over her filmography. She's been in a lot of things in the past decade and a half. She's just very stone-faced in this. And this, to me, there's tough guy, girl, action heroes, right? And it's easy to play that sort of stone-faced, Eastwood-esque type of character. But the ones who do it the best are the ones where something else is going on behind the eyes. Like, you know, Eastwood was a stone-faced tough guy, but there's something about his eyes. Something else was happening in there. Like, there was a, I wouldn't say a vulnerability, but there was something in there that was at odds with his, you know, intense exterior. He wasn't a stone killer. And I think, you know, in Trinity in The Matrix is the same way. Like, she's very tough, very capable. But there's something vulnerable about her. There's something about her as a filmed actress that contrasts with that. And she doesn't play on it. It's just there. And it makes, I think, tough guy characters need, man or a woman, they need a little bit of vulnerability behind the facade in order to make them fully rounded. And examples of the other side are in the Underworld films, Kate Beckinsale. She's just a one note. She's just one note. There's not a moment in that film where I think, you know, this actress gives a shit about this role or this, that this part is anything interesting. And I feel the same way about Blunt here. This character, Rita Vitansky, is supposed to be this big hero. And she's just trying to play it tough and blank. And it's a one-note kind of performance. And she doesn't, it doesn't impact the movie per se. Like, it's a very entertaining movie, and she plays that part fine. But it's not interesting to me at all. And even later on, when there's a quasi-love, you know, interest between them, I don't buy it. But what I want to talk about in terms of women in film, women in action films, is that, especially for this film, like, there she is, this, you know, and let's face it, right? She's this hero of Verdun, right? And we've met J-Squad, and they're all fucked up. They got scars, tattoos, they're grimy, they got all kinds of piercings. Like, they look like a squad of people who have been in battles, you know? They're all fucked up. And Vitansky's got long hair, okay? And she's beautifully made up. Her face is pristine. And first of all, if you're going into combat, give a shit, men or women, your hair is short. There's no way you're getting it, you know, you're going to be running in an army helmet with long hair or in any way, you know. And plus, on women, long hair is very feminine, you know. And so they want directors or probably producers, right? They want hot women in action films and they want them to be tough and kick ass, but they still have to look like runway models, you know? And I feel like, yeah, Blunt did some working out, so like she looks like she's got some shoulder muscles. You know, she's not Summer Glau, right, in the Chronicles of Sarah Connor, whatever, like these waify models who are supposed to kick ass, or Uma Thurman, like these unbelievable women who look like they would fall down a flight of steps if they weren't, you know, helped up. And they're supposed to be these kick-ass action heroes. And I just find it absurd that they wouldn't cast, or like Linda Hamilton in the second Terminator film was like the closest thing. She was tough looking. Her body was tough. There was something about her that was like, you know, she didn't have to do the feminine beauty thing. You know, it wasn't like going into battle, let me get some eyeliner going here. You know, I know this is Hollywood, right? I know it's a Hollywood film, but you know, guys look like tough military guys, and women look like, you know, hot models in, like, you know, nice-looking armor that's shaped around their breasts. Like, it's, there's all this crap. So part of the problem with her character is the actress herself. The other part is really, for me, what I'm seeing clashing on the screen is they want to show a tough female soldier, but Hollywood can't let go of the fact that she still has to be glamorous. It bothers me. I mean, it doesn't really bother me that it takes me out of the movie too much, but it introduces just enough of a sense of unreality where I'm sort of like, okay, you know, where I might be taken into the movie more if they had done it in a way where she really is a war hero. Like, and when you see them fighting against the mimics, to be a war hero in this kind of conflict, man, you have been through some shit. You know, you're lucky to have all of your limbs intact. And you know, Emily Blunt looks like she stepped off of a magazine cover. So anyway, end rant, but just kind of wanted to say my piece on that. So now we're introduced to this Dr. Carter, this other character, and now we get the big exposition about the mimics. You know, there's this, they're in front of this computer screen, so we're getting this visual, you know, said animatics of what the mimics look like, and a demonstration that you know, they're a hive mind. Again, it's an old sci-fi trope. There's nothing new here. So there's a central brain that's running them, and there's like 80, 90% of them are these drones, the main mimic soldiers. And then there are larger drones. There's like one in every, I don't know, there's one in every, you know, I guess, army or collective force. And the sort of larger blue ones called alphas. What we're taught is that the Omega that controls everything has the power to control time. What happens is the alphas, the blue aliens, are the trigger points. So every time a blue alien is killed in battle, the Omega actually resets the day and it learns about the human tactics of that day. So the humans have been getting killed because every time they kill an alpha, the day resets. The mimics sort of know exactly what's going to happen. They could, you know, every battle is fought this way. So like the humans have no chance. We also find out that this whole, you know, victory of Verdun, which was sort of the first, you know, the humans are striking back, and Rita Vitasky is the hero of Verdun. The aliens allowed the humans to win because they wanted to lure war-winning human force into battle so they can annihilate them and kind of be done. What we find out is blood from these alphas when they're killed, and Rita had done this in the Battle of Verdun, when they kill an alpha but the blood flows into their blood, the power to reset the day is passed from the alphas into the human who now has the alpha blood in them. So Vertasky, it happened at Verdun because she had this ability for a while, and then she lost it. And we find out that she lost it because she got hurt. I don't know if we have found out this now or later, but you know, whenever too much blood or the loss of blood or new blood is put into a human being who has this power, it sort of crowds out the Omega or the Alpha blood, and they can no longer have the power to reset. What she tells Cage is, like, in order to retain this power, he has to die every day. And it's a little sketchy because first they're telling us he needs new blood. And perhaps, you know, underneath it all is that if the body makes new blood every day, maybe that's part of the deal. But so basically, the rules of the movie are that he has to die every day to retain the power. So he tells him, "You're crazy. You know, let's just go to the general." And Rita says, "I've done that before. And, you know, they put me in a psych ward and I was dissected." And so we get more exposition. When the Omega began to search for Rita, you know, the Omega realized that, you know, the power to reset the day was now in human control, that she began to have visions of the Omega and where it was located. And so she's telling Cage that, you know, once the Omega starts looking for you, you're going to start to have visions. And in those visions, if we're smart, we can figure out where the hell the thing is and get to it and kill it. Cage is a little skeptical, and he's like, "Have you ever actually seen it?" And Rita said, "No, I got the visions, but I never actually saw it." Cage says, "You want me to, you know, get you off the beach to kill this thing? I'm not even trained for combat." And then we cut to, you know, now we're into the second act where he's going to have to be trained. So that's our setup. And so far, the film so far has been terrific. I mean, the premise is, it's a crazy premise that's broken down so clearly and done and shot so well. It's amazing that they pulled it off, I have to say. I'm really impressed. And, you know, and they lay out the way it works in such a wonderful, entertaining way that's both gruesome and difficult and funny at the same time, which is pretty amazing. I think most of the casting is really good. The grunts are great, all different, you know, types and races. And Cruz is his self, as he always is. Brendan Gleeson is great. You know, I don't think Blunt is very good in this, but I've said my bit on that. So now we begin, you know, the training sequence. He is terrible. And basically, Rita is the true star here, and she's like a perfect killing machine because she's gone through this before, and she's used this power to train herself up to be, you know, nearly unbeatable. So now we start this training, and a lot of times Cage gets maimed, you know, irreversibly while he's training, and she has to kill him to reset the day. You know, it happens over and over again, and he's basically like, look, you know, how long is it going to take me to learn all this? You know, have you tried to transfer the power via sex? And she's like, I tried it. How many times? You know, and she shoots him. So, you know, what they make funny is her killing him over and over again in different ways. Like, you know, and he's at one point, he's like, I think I broke my back. I can only feel my lips. She kills him. And he gets hit by another one drone, and he's in the back. He's like, no, I'm okay. I think I'm okay. And she kills him again. So it's all these ways where he's, you know, he's trying to lie to her, to tell her that, you know, he's not hurt as bad as she thinks. But of course, they have no time for him to be hurt at all. So every time he gets hurt, she kills him to reset the day. And it's very funny. And this is, in this sequence, they start this theme, which I really like, which is the underlying theme of this movie and very, very purposely put here, and I love it. But the theme of failure as a tool to learn, and the amount of times that Cage fails, you know, the amount of times he failed initially on the beach just to survive to get to Vertaski, and now the amount of times he's failing as he's training with her and over again, it's great. So it's setting up this theme. And at one point, at one of the resets, he finally gets a vision of the Omega, and we see, and you know, different types of film stock. The Omega is in some dam somewhere; it's holed up, and he sees some German writing. And so now their goal is like they got to get off the beach, and get past the battle, and find some transportation to head out towards that dam. So there's this whole sort of montage-ish sequence where they start learning the battlefield, and you know, you have to go 15 steps left, duck, and then shoot, and go here, and you see them almost like a football playbook. They're diagramming out the battlefield and dying over and over and over again and trying to figure out how to get, you know, past this beach. The battle is so incredibly chaotic. It's imaginably difficult. And again, you see them failing over and over and over and over again. The theme is part of the film. They don't just do like the him dying and resetting, and then all of a sudden he's a perfect soldier. Like, they stay with the theme of everything being extremely difficult and the amount of times that the characters have to die to learn it. And this doesn't let up, which I think is one of the film's strengths. One reset day, Cage decides that he doesn't want to go to the beach. He escapes from the base, and he goes by motorcycle to London, take the day off, and he's standing on the London Bridge during when the battle has been going on, and all of a sudden you see, you know, coming up the Thames, you know, thousands of mimics coming through the water. So we come to understand that, you know, if the battle is lost, London gets completely overwhelmed. It's a really cool shot, and of course he dies again. Cage finally, he like takes it up a level now. This kind of a desperation that they've got to get off that beach. And so now, you know, he and Rita are like these twin whirlwinds of death on the battlefield, and they're just like unstoppable. During one of them, you know, he actually saves J Squad that's taking refuge in that crater. And of course, in the very first day, you know, Cruz was this wet recruit who knew nothing. And at one point, he kind of storms around and he kills all the mimics to save them. And they're all looking at him like, you know, who is this guy? You know, he was a major stripped to rank, and he's like this amazing warrior now. It's funny. It's a good moment. So in this sequence, they kind of punch through and they get off the beach and they go to this trailer park. You know, they grab a car with a thing attached to the back, and there's a mimic in the sort of the trailer attached to the back, and there's a brief battle. When they kill the mimic and the trailer gets, you know, blown up, and now they're driving inland, like they've made it off the beach. And at this point now, like when they got to the trailer park and they fought this mimic, I was really intensely into it because I thought, holy shit, if they die here, you know, they finally got off the damn beach and they made it. And this one stupid mimic, this one dumb mimic kills them, they got to do it all over again. And I was really intensely into it, you know, very invested. And it made me think very much like it was like playing a video game with really shitty save points to those video game, you know, players out there. Where you play a certain game where it doesn't save for long stretches of time. So, like, you know, if you have to go through a long period of the game and you know if you're going to die, you're going to reset. It sucks, but the tension in the game is unbelievable. So I want to segue briefly and talk about video games because, you know, one thing that I came away with in this film is that this is probably, you know, when we say, oh, movies are like video games, they're all this and the special effects and the shooting and everything, they're like video games. Like, yeah, kind of in one way. This film was written and directed and structured the way you actually play video games. And I had never seen that done on screen before. You know, like this is the first film that really gets into the roots of what it means to play video games. And if you've played games, like it was a 3 or 4 year period when I played pretty heavily and I don't play anymore. But, you know, when I first started playing games, I was so petrified of dying. I was so afraid to die as a character. And every time I died, I'd freak out and get angry and. And then as I learned and played more games, it's like dying is the way you learn when you get killed. And it's exactly, you know, it's exactly the way it's depicted in the film. You know, when you're playing kind of sci-fi action games, it's like, you know, you have to die your way through the landscape sometimes. If it's a really hard game, you don't know about the alien that's hiding behind the rock, you know, 3/4 of the way across the field until you actually encounter it for the first time. And if it kills your ass, now you know it's there. And now you know the next time when you approach it, you're ready for it and you kill it. And this film really got at that spirit, which I thought was great. And I mean, it's very impressive how well this theme works. Like it's really built into the bones of the film for the first 3/4 anyway, for, you know, or maybe 5/6 or something like that. But anyway, I want to point that out, that it's terrific in that way. And I'm really impressed by the fact that it got it so well. So now we're with Vertaski and Cage, and they're driving in this car. Now the film gets a little more conventional in this sequence because now we're like these two characters are in the quiet of there's nothing to learn, there's no aliens, and they're just sitting there getting to know each other. For me, I really didn't find any chemistry between the two leads at all. Vertaski is just this stone-faced, you know, soldier. She's just been at war too long, and she's too hardcore and ardent. She doesn't talk, and it's not very interesting to me. They try to give her some backstory. Cage has been, even in this car, you know, that he's been in the sequence a bunch of times. So now they use the trope of the movie, which I think is clever. They use the trope of the movie to make their relationship interesting because she doesn't know how much he really knows. And she never really knows if the day they're living that he's lived it before and how much, you know, she has said in previous times. And again, it's a very simple trope that drives so much of this movie, but they use it in so many different ways, and I think it's really neat. However, it's pretty lame, and supposedly, you know, she's watched this soldier named Hendrix die 300 times when she was resetting her days, and you know, I didn't care. I didn't feel like she really gave a shit, I just felt like it was a really lame way to try to give her some gravitas. So they run out of gas and they head on out through the countryside, and little by little, their suits both lose power, so they have to abandon the new jacket armor. Shot really well, beautiful countryside, like, you know, some really nice shots here. You know, it's funny for me, I think it's a smart move that they abandon the armor, because in the mundane shots of like the abandoned farmhouse and out in the countryside, the armor looks kind of goofy. Like, in a sense, the armor works well in the battle, in the barracks. You know, it makes sense when they're wearing armor in those scenes. But for them to be trooping through the countryside in armor, it kind of looks goofy. And I wonder if they did it the first time and Lyman saw the rushes and he was like, ah, it looks goofy. You know what? Well, let's have them strip their armor out. Who knows? Just something I was thinking about. So they take refuge in this empty house. You know, they try to do some chemistry and character between the two of them, which to me doesn't work. They discover a helicopter and Rita can fly it. And we also reveal that she's been wounded. Cage bandages her up, you know, supposedly creating chemistry, which it does not. She realizes that he's stalling for whatever reason. And so what the cool reveal is that, you know, they've been in this situation dozens of times before. Like they've made it off the beach dozens and dozens of times. And what he tells her is at this point, he can't figure out a way to save her, like no matter what happens. And he's tried like everything. The minute the helicopter starts up, she dies. And it's almost like this point in a video game that you're playing where you can't, you know, you can't do it a certain way, and you've done it every way you think you can, and it's completely beaten you, you know, and you either have to go, you know, get a playthrough on YouTube or completely rechange your tactics or do something else. And it's at this point, Cage is like, no matter what I do, you die. This is, you don't make it past this point. Here's the crux, is that if she dies and he continues on and kills the Omega, the day doesn't reset and she stays dead. So he's trying to convince her to, like, just, you know, go to another house and just kind of huddle there and let me take care of the Omega. And she's not, basically not going for it. And it's seen, you know, the movie wants us to believe that he's falling in love with her, which is why, you know, he's gone through all these elaborate ways to try to save her. And I think the whole love romantic angle here between the two of them is forced. It doesn't work. They don't need it. They can be buddies, and they feel more like buddies, actually, in the film. They don't feel like lovers. They don't need to be lovers, but it's a Hollywood film. So, again, it's part of, you know, the big-budget movie tropes that doesn't work. And, again, it's another piece of this movie where, like, it takes you out of the movie a little bit. And it also makes no sense that she would be so stubborn that, you know, she knows what it's like to reset, and that he tells her, look, there's no point in you dying, so let me take the helicopter, and I'll survive, I'll kill the Omega, and I'll come back for you. And, like, she refuses to budge, even though she's going to die. And I don't know, it was just an odd thing. And so she gets in the helicopter, starts it up, the mimic comes out of the ground, kills her, and she says something like, my middle name is Rose, and it's never used in the rest of the film, so nobody cares. And in the background, we see a bunch more mimics, and of course, Cage dies. So he resets again, and this time, he doesn't engage Rita. He doesn't go find her, since he knows where the Omega is. So, but at this point, like, and now a change has come over Cruz, and I got to hand it to him. Like, you know, in the first bit of the movie, you know, civilian PR guy, and he's halfway joking around, or he's scared, and he's always under threat. Vertaski's always better than him, and, you know, he's always kind of on the learning side and the underdog, and he's always either scared or under some kind of duress. And at this point, knowing that he can't save Rita, and that, you know, if they don't meet, that he's not going to be able to, like, you know, be with her, that he becomes just, like, his face sets up differently, and he's really badass at this point. So he's suiting up now, you know, and they're back to the first day. But, oh my God, he's been through so much. And nobody fucks with him. Like, he's eye-staring everybody. And at one point, when their J-Squad's finally suiting up, you know, the guy looks at him and he's like, I need an extra battery and as many grenades as you can give me. He totally just, bam, you know, he drives through the battle like a badass you wouldn't believe. He gets past, drives the car, the helicopter. He gets to the dam. And, of course, now he can get to the dam in his suit because he's got an extra battery, which is just, you know, nice movie logic, very smart. And so he gets to the dam. He's got all his extra grenades. But when he leans over the deep well where the Omega's supposed to be, it's not there. And he realizes that it's a trap, that the Omega knows that he's got its power and that there's an alpha there and another drone waiting for him. So he's cornered, and they wound him, and they basically, you know, they want to wait it out until he either passes out or bleeds out so the alpha can get its power back. He tries to kill himself with a gun. The alpha knocks the gun away from his hand, but at some point he's able to drown himself. He does something where he drowns himself, and he does die, and he resets again. So now we're back with Rita and Carter again, and he's gone and met Rita and Carter, like, in, you know, one of the resets, and he tells them that the visions are a lure, it's a trap, and the Omega is not there. They don't know how to find it, and, you know, they don't know what to do next. They're kind of like, you know, everything's been revealed as sort of, you know, a game that was rigged from the start. Up to this point in the film, I mean, this has been a crackerjack story. A very unorthodox idea has been laid out in incredibly solid and easily digestible fashion, you know, and each shot in the film has been inextricably linked to the story. Like, there hasn't been a piece of fat on this film up until this point. This is when things start to kind of let go a little bit. What we hear next is that this Carter guy used to be like a expert in the mimics and mimic biology. He used to be a, you know, civilian back in London, and he's developing this piece of hardware that if it comes in contact with an alpha's blood, it sort of like would light up the sort of, you know, pathways that connect all the alphas and the omega, and they could figure out where the omega was. You know, the one that he has on base doesn't work, it's broken, but the prototype that he believes does work is in the general's office back in London. You know, you get this moment of like, well, how the hell are you going to get an alpha to plug into? And then Cruz realizes that he has alpha blood in him, so they don't need an alpha, they have him. You know, now we're on our sort of heading towards the third act type of thing. Again, they use the main idea of this story to get in and get the general to sort of open the safe where this thing is. And so, you know, them getting into the general's office is very much, you know, they must have done it like 100 times because, you know, they know all the beats to wait before people come out of bathrooms. And it's clever, right? It's like, you know, again, it's like another video game. It's like they had to learn it. And so they finally use, you know, Cage's power to reset. They get all the way in to his office. And even in his office, there are all these moments where he's like, the phone rings and he knows he's on the other end. The general secretary comes in and he's like, I know what she's going to say. And so he dazzles Brigham with all this foreknowledge. And he's like, you know, in the safe in your office right now is a device which will allow me to locate this Omega and kill it. But up until now, you know, I haven't been able to convince you. And of course, you know, this time, for whatever reason, Brigham walks over, opens it up and hands them this device. But we realize the general is very cagey, as he was last time. And when the doors open, they're confronted by all these soldiers. So again, it takes a few more resets for them to figure out how to get out of the building. And they finally wind up in a parking garage, and sitting in the passenger seat of a car, Cage jams the device into his leg. And there's some sequence where he realizes that the Omega is underneath the Louvre, which has been flooded. In a really cool twist, once they have this information, a soldier in London in one of the armored jackets smashes their car. Both Cage and Vertansky are knocked out. And so Cage wakes up in an infirmary, and immediately he looks up and he realizes that, you know, they've put a couple of pints of plasma in his system. He's screwed, and he's lost the power to reset. Now we've got it's a nice setup. I mean, a really good setup is that, you know, they've got to kill the Omega before the invasion. You know, they got 3 hours to get to Paris, kill the Omega, you know. And of course, at this point, you know, they can't reset to get there. So from London, they've got to get to Paris, and they're, you know, fugitives basically. So there's this great line when Cage is like, we're going to need more soldiers. And Vertansky says, who the hell's crazy enough to follow us to Paris? And we know right away that J-Squad is the only, you know, is the only chance that they have. They get back to base, and basically, you know, Cage uses all the information that he's gleaned about J-Squad from all of the resets. I mean, there must be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of resets. He knows everything about these people, these secrets that none of them even know about each other. And it makes sense in the story. You know, like, again, they're using what Cage's power is for, and that's his tool to get through certain problems in certain situations, which is cool. You know, what's great in this moment is they're unconvinced, even with all that. They're still, you know, not completely convinced until Vertansky comes up and joins them. Because in a way, again, this is the first day, and they're like, this raw deserter is spinning us this whole tale about the war. And, you know, there's no way they can kind of buy it. And the movie's good because it puts Vertansky, who is the, you know, the greatest warrior of them all, there with him to back up a story. And at that point, they're in. Now, this is where the film sort of, to me, where the really crackerjack, interesting, well-acted, well-shot film ends. And the by-the-numbers, you know, action film we've seen 1,000 times begins. Because, you know, Cage can't use his power anymore. So we're not resetting the day, you know. And we've seen the mimics in action, you know, lots and lots of times. So they're not novel. We've seen the soldiers in action. They're not novel. The one catch, you know, as they're flying at night towards Paris, they realize is they can't kill an alpha because the aliens have the ability to reset the day now again. There's this nice moment where, you know, they tell, and the sucky thing about it is, I guess it's not completely sucky, but they tell one of the soldiers says, well, what if we come up against one of these things? And Vertansky says, you take one for the team and you let it kill you, you know, which is kind of cool. They don't use it at all except right at the end. And I feel like it could have been, you know, that itself would have been a great way to generate a little more drama, which is sorely needed here. So at this point, like, all the soldiers are gung-ho. They're explaining, you know, about the aliens' power to reset the day, which nobody knows. Like, in a way, they've come over too far to Cage doesn't quite ring true. So it's the only thing that didn't kind of make sense to me at that point. So at some point, they get into the area of the Louvre, and the dropship is like decimated by fire. Cage is separated from the rest of them, and he falls in the water, nearly drowns. His armor takes him all the way down, so he has to climb out of it to get to the surface, which he does. And they kind of regroup, and there are these shots of now them in deserted nighttime Paris, which are really cool, actually. Lyman does some really great work here. But still, it just feels like, you know, your basic action sequence. And so the idea they come up with is that there's like a couple of football fields between them and the Louvre Pyramid, which is where they need to get to. And it's, you know, they'll never make it because of the amount of mimics. So the notion is that they'll try to restart the dropship because it's not completely, it just can't fly. And they'll use it to kind of, you know, along the ground, just sort of motor towards the Louvre and just get through the mimics as fast as possible. So two of the soldiers sort of take on a bunch of the mimics away from the dropship and sacrifice themselves so the dropship can get moving, which is cool. And then there's this whole battle where, you know, the dropship is going and the mimics are behind it, and there's one guy and a huge gun inside the dropship, and he's killing mimics, and there's this big battle at night, and it's okay. The entire squad is lost in the process, and now it's just Vertansky and Cage, and they're being stalked by an alpha. So there's one point where they realize that one of them has to distract the alpha and the other one has to go for the omega. And then there's this sort of, you know, before the end moment where Vertansky goes to Cage and she's like, it was great knowing you. You're a good man, Cage. And there's a kiss. Again, there's no sexual chemistry between these two. And it just seems very perfunctory that, you know, Tom Cruise has to have a love interest in this film because whatever, they have to have a love interest. But it doesn't matter to the film at all. And it actually doesn't feel quite right. It makes this very rote last act seem even more cliched. So, you know, they're both... There's lots of movement and action in the dark, and none of it's very interesting. You can't see very well, and we see Rita getting killed by the Alpha, and now the Alpha's after Cage. Cage dives into the flooded basement, and he's swimming towards the Omega. He's wounded mortally by the Alpha, but he drops the grenades, and they sink, and the Omega swallows them. The thing explodes. You know, the Omega dies, but Cruz sort of falls into the Omega, and as it's dying, we see all the Omega's blood kind of flow into him. And again, you know, he takes his power back, which doesn't make any sense. Because if the Omega was the thing that had the power to reset the day, the Omega is dead. And so even though he has the Omega's blood, I mean, I guess you could say that the blood of the Omega is the thing that has the power to reset time. I think right in that moment, and in a couple of lines to come, they're setting it up for a sequel. Because it's possible now that, you know, Cage has this, again, he's got this Omega in his blood. And I could see them setting up a sequel where he can't lose the power and they have to sort of capitalize on it. But the very careful constructed lines that we hear in the newscast is that, you know, the aliens have lost the will to bring the fight, or have lost the will to fight. We don't hear that all the aliens have died, that the alien threat has ended. You know, there's no clear line to end all this. And I just, of course, they want to leave as many options open as possible for a sequel city. What's happened is the day has been reset. And again, it doesn't make any sense because after he gets the blood by the Alpha, the next shot of him is in the helicopter, which was when he was on his way to the generals in the first film. And when he lands in London, the battle's already over. You know, there was no battle, like in some weird way. Somehow, the human forces have figured out that, you know, all of the enemy is kind of dropping down. And it's very vague and it's very kind of cliched. And I don't know. It didn't matter. At that point, you know, the third act was just what it was. I was just like, whatever, you set me up for a sequel. I don't care. Cage actually goes to Heathrow himself. And we see J-Squad running, doing their calisthenics, and the Master Sergeant. Of course, they don't know who he is. And, Cage makes his way to the firing range and he sees Vertansky, and of course she doesn't know him, and she's like, what do you want? And he starts laughing and smiling, and the film ends. And that's it for Edge of Tomorrow. So I really liked the film. I was so very impressed by the writing and direction for the first probably 5/6 of this film. They had one, you know, twist. Cage had this one power, and they used it in multiple ways to drive the story forward. And I thought that it was very disciplined and very clever, and it was directed very like crackerjack. You know, the director just getting out of the way of the story. You know, Lyman was just like, Really, and it was really impressive too, you know, because Lyman's been around, right? And if he wants to kind of be a big showy director, he can. But he gets out of the way of this story and just shoots it very economically, and he lets the story and the writing really flow. And I don't think that needs to happen in every movie. I'm not a slave to, you know, good writing. Movies are a visual medium, obviously. But I think it's smart in this case. I think it really works. And until they are on their way to Paris to battle the Omega, it's a crackerjack science fiction film, you know? And the fact that it also has this little, you know, subtext of, you know, live, die, repeat, which has become, that was the tagline of the film, right? And that it really inhabits what it's like to play video games, I thought was really terrific. The third act was a real letdown. I didn't like Emily Blunt in the film at all. I didn't like, not a fan of how they use women in action films in certain ways, you know, like go all the way. I didn't think she was very good. I didn't think there was any chemistry between the two of them. The whole third act in Paris to me was very boring, only because of the crackerjack and novel way that the rest of the film was structured, you know, that third act was just kind of fell apart. And the ending was just, I didn't really get any satisfaction in the ending at all. Just, it kind of, you know, there was this kind of ending that was grabbing things it needed just in case it wanted to be a sequel. And I thought it was kind of, you know, really, really a letdown in that way. But for a lot of it, really, really liked it. So, yeah, so there you have it. My analysis of Edge of Tomorrow. I want to thank everybody for listening. You can find us on iTunes and you can find us on any smartphone device that has like a podcast app. Just type in Sci-Fi On Screen and you can subscribe. We're also at scifionscreen.com and there's a Facebook page, Sci-Fi On Screen, as well. And really, really much enjoy doing the show and looking forward to the next one and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Thanks a lot.